Hey, welcome to this week's edition of the Texas Legislative Update. I'm David Blackman, and I'm here with Jason Modlin, who's the president of the Texas Alliance of Energy Producers. Jason, how are you doing today?
I'm good, David. How are you?
Just great. Just great. I understand it got cold in Austin overnight.
It did. It's 45 degrees here, and a wake-up call coming back from Mexico late last night, and where it left, and it was 80 degrees, and so yeah, quite the change.
We got lucky here in Mansfield. We had some of the nastiest looking storm clouds I have ever seen that skirted maybe 2 miles north of us and hit Arlington, and you know, went on over into through Dallas, had a lot of hail up here. It was really,
oh,
really some
goodness.
Nasty looking weather.
We had quite a few thunderstorms, so it made it a little dicey flying back in, but it was very pretty here in Central Texas.
Well, we're doing, this is our eighth episode of the podcast. This means that the week ended March 17th was the ninth week of the Texas legislature. We missed 1 week when I was on vacation. You know, I wasn't smart enough to come back on Thursday from that vacation, so we missed that week. But here we are. It was another, you know, kind of eventful week in Austin. But it was also, I think we ought to start out talking about something happening in Washington in the House with House Resolution 1, H.R. 1, whose lead sponsor is the minority or the majority leader, Steve Scalise from Louisiana. Talk about what that bill would do.
Yeah, so H.R. 1, the Lower Energy Cost Act, was introduced by Steve Scalise, who's the majority leader in the House, and it would do a couple different things. One, it's designed to increase production and exports here in the United States, and so there's a couple different permitting and tax policies that it focuses on. And then the next part is reducing regulatory burdens that make it harder to build infrastructure throughout the United States. And so that's really getting at kind of the permitting reform aspects of things. And so this is a way really to increase domestic production. And so targeting those federal land policies, making sure that golf leases are held and auctioned off on time twice a year, which has been kind of the norm for the last 4 years and all of a sudden has stopped under this administration. But then also addressing those 7,000 leases that the president likes to point to make sure that permits are actually exercised on those and companies can get out there and start to explore and ultimately produce that acreage. That's definitely starting to be an issue in New Mexico and parts where there's quite a bit more federal land than Texas. The permitting reform is really what's exciting for Texas, finding ways to increase our export capability along our Gulf Coast. And so whether that's oil and gas terminals or LNG terminals, those would really be the big opportunities. And then pipelines into the Northeast. You know, we've talked about it several times when it got cold in New York several years ago. They didn't have the resources to tap into their neighbor Pennsylvania, which was has a prolific gas field up there. And instead, they relied on LNG imports. Sometimes that's from Trinidad and Tobago, but other times it's from Russia. And so, you know, it's crazy that the Northeast is really held captive to the Atlantic market because they refuse to build pipelines. So this is an opportunity to potentially build some more pipelines across the United States, increase production on federal lands. And as the majority leader points out, that would lower energy costs here in the United States, help to spur some economic activity, and continue really to make the United States a leader in manufacturing.
So it's going to pass the House probably on a partisan vote, almost purely party line vote. Do any of the permitting reforms apply to renewable energy to try to get maybe some Democratic support in the Senate, you know, where the Democrats have a very small majority, but a big enough majority to matter.
Yeah, so the reforms that are made to the National Environmental Policy Act apply to energy projects in general. And so that would include renewable projects, whether it's large transmission lines or whether it's new wind farms that are off the coast or things of that nature that have been held up by NEPA reviews. You know, there's always a lot of focus on NEPA, but that's just about a dozen reviews, federal reviews that companies have to go through. So, you know, it's an easy talking point, I think, for everybody to point to, but you still have to do lots of prevailing wage and Endangered Species Act and other types of anytime you're dealing with the tribe or other types of communities, you have to address those issues. So, you know, it's one of about a dozen different types of reviews that companies have to go through, but if there can be some alignment and some agreement on that, I know Chuck Schumer has already said that this is probably DOA when it arrives in the Senate. Maybe there are parts of it, particularly as it relates to permitting reform, that could be could morph into the Manchin permitting reform bill that we have yet to see. Manchin has said he's going to defer to the House first to act, so we'll see how far they can get in the House. Maybe get some bipartisan support, and then see what the Senate can put together.
Two things about this. This is a prime example of why that special election in Georgia, that Senate election runoff between Warnock and Herschel Walker, was so crucial, because it gave the Democrats a 51-49 majority in the Senate, and Manchin's vote isn't the deciding vote on it right now, right? Mm-hmm. Manchin can vote for this bill. They still got 50 against it, and Kamala Harris, you know, cast a tie-breaking vote against the bill. So that's one thing. Second thing is, talking about NEPA being the key reform here, and this is the central conundrum with permitting reform in general, is all of the restrictions, all the holdups to permitting have to do with one or two things at the federal level. It's either an environmental restriction or it's stakeholder rights, like Indian tribes. You mentioned Native American interests. And, you know, and those are important. I mean, all these stakeholder rights are important, and they're generally protected rights by major statutes or even in the Constitution. And it becomes very, very difficult to say, well, you know, your rights don't matter where this pipeline is concerned or this wind farm is concerned. And the Endangered Species Act isn't going to matter here. And so whenever you try to, you know, put in place these reforms to speed up permitting, that's why you end up with all the protest groups, all the conflict groups on the left, like the Sierra Club and others, weighing in against any proposal that's going to speed up permitting, because it inevitably impacts these big environmental statutes that, you know, to be fair, some of them have done a great deal of good in terms of cleaning up the environment and protecting endangered species in this country. And so, man, it's really controversial and a very, very difficult thing to done. It's why I don't think it's ever really probably going to get done in the United States Congress. I don't know what
that's right
is, but yeah.
No, I agree with that. I think the only way that you really can get things done, unfortunately, just the amount of bureaucracies, is that you have to really champion these projects and really lead on that. You know, the interstate highway system would not have been built had it not been for the president really driving it home. Let me rephrase that. Not been built today.
It couldn't be built today. Yeah.
Back then, there were not the same loopholes. Obviously, EPA was not an entity back then. But today, it just could not occur. You're literally, you know, paving paradise, right? And so finding that ability to champion and get big projects done is why, you know, we always went, you know, when Secretary Granholm or Secretary Kerry talk about we need to follow China's lead, that's what they're referring to, is the ability to just steamroll and build big projects. And unfortunately today, there's not really a bipartisan agreement on what that looks like. Is it a new electric grid system across the United States that could move renewables out of Texas and out of the Midwest into both coasts? Is it more pipelines into the Northeast or into our friends in the North and in the South that want to be able to move oil south and gas south, and you know, all those important things? So we just haven't seen that yet, that level of either leadership from the president or bipartisan agreement in Congress.
Right. And it's just, yeah, it's really hard to see how it happens. I just, you know, I admire everybody that's working on it. I admire Mr. Scalise, have long admired Mr. Scalise. He's very effective and good at what he does. And I know August Pfluger is one of the member sponsors of that bill from West Texas. And so it's, you know, they're doing great work, and it's a good thing to be working on. But at the end of the day, it's just hard to see where that compromise, that coalition, gets the 51 votes in the Senate. And even if you get the 51, then you're probably going to have to overcome a filibuster. And that means you got to get the 60, and that's even harder to see how that happens. But anyway, you got to try, right?
That's right. You got to try. You mentioned August Pfluger out of Midland, San Angelo area. He's got a bill up next week, H.R. 1141. This is the Natural Gas Tax Repeal Act. You and I have talked about this a number of times. The methane tax that got placed into the Inflation Reduction Act. And really, it's kind of shadow boxing right now. We really don't know what it will look like in its final form. The EPA has to take the lead on crafting that tax, which is certainly an odd agency. They don't typically create taxes. And so that's where it's at. You know, there have been some estimates out there that it will cost upwards of $579 million for the domestic oil and gas industry to comply with this in 2025. And so what that means is that would be a higher cost on natural gas for customers, you and I, heating our homes, but then also the power companies on their electricity prices, and then obviously manufacturers that rely on domestically sourced natural gas. So it kind of remains to be seen what that tax will look like. Again, this is another one where Senator Manchin is not quite willing to take that up just yet. But I think it's largely because we need to see ultimately how EPA will build it out and structure it. And if it's just a tax on natural gas use, which is ultimately what most energy taxes are, then you might have some friendly congressional leaders say, this is not quite what we were aiming at. We were trying to incentivize some better behavior in terms of lower emissions. But really, the only way to implement this is just an energy tax, and that doesn't solve anything.
Right, right. And we all end up paying for it at the end of
that. That's right. That's right.
So back in Austin, you know, we had some stuff going on in Austin this week. I know in the Senate, they, for instance, introduced their various bills, the Lieutenant Governor's priority bills on grid reform. Senate Bill 6 would, you know, require the addition of more dispatchable capacity to the grid. And Senate Bill 7 would... is interesting to me because basically what it would do is require renewable energy generation to behave under the same rules as everybody else has to behave, right? And of course, that's what the media is going to most object to, I guess, in Texas.
That's right. We touched a little bit on it last week, but now you've seen kind of the media reaction to the Lieutenant Governor and senators rolling out their package. It makes a lot of sense that we think about dispatchable energy with URI being our benchmark. We have a lot of wind and solar installed in this state. We have a lot of batteries that have come online. Those are fantastic when it's a nice, breezy, sunny day. And we're able to utilize all three of those technologies. If it's extremely cold or extremely hot, all of those technologies tend to have lower outputs. And so you need the ability to turn on something. And it's not coal, it's not nuclear, just given both of those technologies and the limitations on their emissions. And that leaves natural gas as the only remaining source to be dispatchable. The Lieutenant Governor has championed a set of bills, as have a number of senators, to really look at how do we start to address the uneven market. And we were talking a little bit before the podcast. I mean, Dallas Morning News editorial board saying that we're a free market state, and a free market state means you don't put your thumb on the scale as it relates to one energy source or another. But that unfortunately is not the landscape that we're living in.
That's exactly what we've been doing in favor of renewables for 25 years now. It's like they have no self-awareness at all. It's amazing.
That's right. That's right. So we have had phenomenal growth in those and those types of energy sources entirely because they're propped up and widely supported by the federal government, allowing them to essentially bid into our market at a zero price point. And so they've done phenomenally well because of those subsidies from the federal government. And the real question that the Senate is asking, which it would be phenomenal if any reporter would pick up on, is what do we do when we have too many wind and solar facilities on the grid and then they fail? Do we just go without power for a week? And that's what occurred in URI and for a number of Texans. Or do we figure out, is there backstops in place that we need? Do those backstops run regularly, or are they only come in emergency situations? And you know, it can be debated how cost effective those different strategies are. But what's that right percentage? Is it you know, is it 40%? Is it 50% of your overall electric mix is the top end? We're quickly approaching wind and solar exceeding 50% of installed capacity.
Yeah.
And so when URI happens and output on wind drops to near zero, solar drops to 4%. Thinking about that, you would need to install for wind 100 times more than we have today in order to get the output that you were expecting. Solar 25 times more that you were expecting. And so, you know, we just don't have the available land for that, let alone the transmission lines and things of that nature. So, you know, that's the central question that the Senate is trying to wrestle with, is how do we make sure that we're somewhat of balancing this market when we continue to have all of this pressure from the federal government saying build more wind and solar.
Yeah. And just how do you keep the lights on when you have a winter storm, or when it's 105 degrees in Dallas and 110 right. in Uvalde on a given day? The biggest problem for wind and solar, and again, I'm not anti-wind and anti-solar, but the biggest issue is they fail when you need them the most. When it's unusually warm or unusually cold is when they tend to most reliably fail. Or as their spokesman said at the hearing 2 years ago, when they perform as expected, which is exactly right. That's what we expect them to do. And so you know, we're woefully short of dispatchable reserve capacity, and we need more. And, you know, Lieutenant Governor Patrick and Senator Schwertner and others should be commended for moving down this road and trying to get this done. Meanwhile, what, if anything, is happening on this in the House? I have to admit, I haven't really seen much on the House side from this yet.
Yeah, there have been a few filings by Chairman Todd Hunter out of Corpus Christi. He's the state affairs chairman. Yeah. He did pick up a few bills from that package, not all of them. And what he has told folks is that they're going to defer to the Senate to get their package over. As we touched on last week, these are top priorities for the Senate. Lieutenant Governor has been very good about moving his top priorities very quickly in sessions past. And so that will get to the House. And then I would imagine a pretty robust debate on how to move forward. I did just get a text a little while ago that I think we're all going to be trying to understand is the Court of Appeals said that the PUC was in the wrong for keeping the $9,000 price point per megawatt for so long during Uri. And so that has all sorts of implications in terms of pricing and what some of the challenges are going to be moving forward. The subsequent commission, as you remember, they wiped out the board. They appointed new commission members. They adopted a new rule and a new cost curve that lowered that price point pretty substantially, but allowed for generators to recover their cost a little bit quicker so that there would be more generation brought online sooner. So that kind of addresses that issue moving forward, but that look back from the court might change things around the building. So we'll see what that looks like.
Yeah, that could happen. That tends to happen sometimes.
That's right.
I know you wanted to talk about a bill from the Texas Produced Water Consortium, Senate Bill 1047.
That's, absolutely.
Hopefully moving this time.
Yeah, so Senator Perry out of Lubbock area, and then Carl Tepper, a brand new representative out of the Lubbock area as well, have introduced Senate Bill 1047, and then in the House, it's House Bill 2757. What this would do is extend and continue the Texas Produced Water Consortium. Last session, the consortium was created at Texas Tech University to really look at beneficial uses of produced water outside of the oil and gas industry. Recycling efforts have been fairly robust the last 5 or 6 years, really taking some of that produced water that comes out of the ground as you're producing oil and gas and other byproducts, liquids from the ground. But largely all you can do with it is dispose of it. And so the industry moved pretty quickly to say, well, we can capture some of this and utilize it for hydraulic fracturing purposes. And I've heard other folks have started extending it to mud and actual drilling operations. And so that's pretty exciting. But that's a small percentage of the overall mix of produced water. And so what can we potentially do with that? And so there's some exciting bills this session looking at if you can mine lithium or other types of rare minerals out of that, and what would that regulatory structure look like? But this is really a forum for environmentalists, for academia, for government, and for industry to come together. We had lots of meetings over the past 2 years and culminated in a few in-person meetings in Lubbock. And we're excited to, one, support this bill, be members of the consortium again, and then hopefully see some pilot projects really start to take shape in the Permian Basin. The Permian's been the focus of this because of the amount of production out there, 5 million barrels of oil. That corresponds somewhere around 20 million barrels of produced water on any given day. And so That's a lot of water. So figuring out what to do with it, where it could possibly go, potentially for ag irrigation, potentially for conservation efforts. You know, you're restoring fields or environmental flows, or potentially for industrial activity. I think we're quite a ways away in our understanding and in our environmental controls for anything close to municipal use. So that we're not talking about that, but there might be some opportunities before that to look for other areas of where this water can go that is not being disposed of downhole.
Yeah, there's just so many potential opportunities when you can clean this water up to where it's potable quality water for ag use, you know, and industrial uses, that it's really seems well worth, you know, renewing this to do this research, because it just, you know, water's just going to be as big an issue in Texas as any other issue on the table. And the more we can learn about it and take advantage of this, you know, this flowback water for reuse is just a benefit to everyone. So glad that's moving forward. The other thing you wanted to talk about is the governor's press release on related to ESG this week.
Yeah.
You know, so which always comes up somehow every week.
Well, yes. Last week, we touched on it a little bit, and Senator Paxton, excuse me, not Senator Paxton, Attorney General Paxton had an announcement on that. But this week was the governor and really announced that Texas is going to continue its efforts made last session and pushing back on financial institutions that prohibit or boycott energy companies, oil and gas companies. This session, he wants to take a look at insurance companies that are seemingly doing the same thing. Obviously, policies that relate to oil and gas, be it environmental protection or spills or other types of that nature, but then just simply insurance for the movement of oil and gas, which is certainly critical in the shipping industry and exports. If there were limitations placed on oil and gas operations, that would be extremely detrimental. And so I think the Senate is kind of taking the lead on this as well. Senator Brian Hughes had a hearing in Marshall last year that got a lot of headlines because he had subpoenaed BlackRock and some of the other, I believe State Street was the other one, to come to Marshall, Texas and have a pretty long hearing on that. And insurance was really kind of the next phase of where the Senate wanted to take things is looking at that space, making sure that there weren't insurers that were negatively impacting oil and gas operations in the state. And if that is the case, potentially limiting their ability to either license with the state or permit with the state. So that'll be an interesting turn for where this is taking.
Well, so I guess I can't really think of it. I'm just trying to think of what else we needed to bring up here. Jane Nelson was confirmed as Secretary of State, which I guess is the first confirmed Secretary of State that we've had in Texas in 6 years. We've been operating with unconfirmed Secretaries of State for 6 years now.
It's been a while. I'm not exactly sure what the issues are, because we've had some phenomenal appointees during that time.
Yeah,
very good people, either out of the governor's office or out of the Supreme Court, and really, really good interim Secretary of State. But very happy to see Senator Jane Nelson, now Secretary Nelson, confirmed, and she'll do a phenomenal job.
Yeah, she was a wonderful senator for 30 years, man. She was there for a long time and did some great things for Texas. So glad to know she's going to be in that job. It's a job you don't think about much unless you're trying to find election results on election night, because the Secretary of State's office, of course, manages the elections in the state. So I had no idea that we hadn't had a confirmed Secretary of State for 6 years. That's really wild. What else? Anything else before we call it good for this week?
I think that's kind of the big things. I'm hitting the road again, so I'm headed to DC next week. Our talk on HR1, that's supposed to be on the floor next week, along with about 25 other bills that House Republicans have packaged together to make a big energy push next week. And so it'll be a fun time in DC. The cherry blossoms are blooming.
It's beautiful out there.
But I'll be back at the end of the week, and we'll recap the legislature again.
Of course, next week is the 10th week of the session, so next Friday will officially be the halfway point, 20-week session, and we'll see where we are then. With that, I guess we'll call it good for this week. Thank you, Jason.